I'm very well, thank you, my chairperson. How are you?
If you are well, I can see that members are here. Let me say just good morning to all the members who are here. Tuesday 20. I'm sure the department is also here. Let me hear from Valerie, who's not here.
Morning, Chair. The department is here. We have our stakeholders in the meeting that will be presenting. I see most of the members are here this morning. We have one apology from Mr. Sithole, who's attending a tourism meeting that's sitting at the same time today.
Is Honorable Yabo with us today?
Chair, I haven't seen him online yet. I know that his other committee is also meeting. He normally apologizes, so I will let you know when he's in the meeting.
Okay. Who from the department is here, Valerie?
It is the people from the legal department who will be responding to the bill. The people who are actually working on the bill. The DG is not in this meeting, and not or the minister. It's the staff that will be working on.
Okay. No. Thanks. As I've said earlier on, you are all heartily welcomed, honourable members. I think at this point, before I continue to welcome the stakeholders, let me indicate from the onset that I'm not going to be in this meeting for too long. I need to attend to a doctor. I have an appointment today with the doctor. So for the smooth sailing of the meeting, I think we should at this point, because after the first presentation, I would like to be released. We should be at this point then allow a process where we can elect an acting chair so that by the time I leave, at least I don't disrupt the meeting by the committee going back to elect an acting chair. So I would request Valerie to conduct this small process of electing an acting chair so that we can then run the meeting smoothly. Valerie?
Chair, I see Mr. Wunsinger had his hand up. Maybe there's a question before we start.
Okay, I did not see that. Maybe I should go to my... yeah, you are right. Honorable Wunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. While you were...
Unmute, sir. You are muted.
You lost his connection, Chair.
He lost his connection. Okay. What do we do when somebody loses his connection before making a point? We'll allow him to come back if that would still be relevant. Can we then move as per the request? Valerie?
Yes, Chair, I will continue. I've noted that you have informed the committee that you have to leave the meeting. So in terms of NRL 159, the committee must elect an acting chairperson in your absence when you are unwell or unable to continue with chairing the session. So, Chair, in terms of the process, I will be asking for nominations from the floor. The member that accepts and gets the most votes from our members will be acting as chairperson. So, Chair, I will now be asking for the members to nominate a chairperson, an acting chairperson for the session. Are there any nominations?
Yes, there are nominations.
Can I ask Mr. Mabena?
Yes, thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. I would like to nominate Honorable Chris Hansen to chair the session while the chairperson is left. And I don't think if needs be, we can reach a consensus and not go to a vote. We can just, for smooth running, we just agree that we'll take over and then we take it from there.
Can I ask again, did you nominate Mr. Mabena?
Honorable Chris Hansen.
Yes, Mr. Winsinger, do you accept the nomination?
I do.
Are there any more nominations?
Yes.
Can I just accept Mr. Chabangu? Because you're an alternate member, I can't ask you to nominate. Member of the committee, unfortunately. Are there any further nominations?
Valerie, I have raised my hand long ago.
I hear you, Mr. Amaka. Can you go ahead? I recognize you.
Yes, I nominate Honorable Mangu to chair when the chairperson is not there.
Mr. Mangu, are you accepting the nomination?
As a member of the Portfolio Committee on Transport in Good Standing, I, Honorable Lisa Mangu, accept nomination to act as chairperson.
Now that we have two nominations, we have Mr. Winsinger, we have Mr. Mangu. Can I see if there are any support for Mr. Winsinger to be acting chairperson for this? Can I ask the members who have their hands up to just lower it, and then raise it when I ask the question. Are there any support for Mr. Winsinger? Can you indicate? I see two hands of Mr. Winsinger, Mr. Winsinger's own hand, and Mr. Mabena.
No,
Yes, Pete May as well.
Yes, Honorable Pete May.
Okay, I'm sorry. I did not see Mr. May's hand on my screen, Mr. May, then. So then there are three supporters for Mr. Winsinger. Can I then hear for Mr. Mangu? I can see Mr. Mangu's hand, Mr. Ramadwa, Mr. McDonald.
Can't you see me, Valerie?
I just want to confirm, is Ms. Noluchungu still in the meeting?
No, she's not.
Then Mr. Chabangu, then you are the fourth person who are supporting Mr. Mangu. Mr. Mangu, you can now continue as acting chairperson.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you, Chairperson and colleagues. Good morning once more. I think that the chair had said he will leave after the first presentation, but he just wanted a smooth transition when he does leave. Am I correct in saying so?
Not. Thanks, Honorable Mangu. I think for a smooth sailing of the meeting, Valerie is correct that you should continue chairing so that when I go, I don't really disrupt the meeting.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to the colleagues for the opportunity and trust to steer this ship together this morning. Once more, I will try very hard to observe my screen, but if I might be missing somebody on any issue, Valerie will help me to remind me. If I may ask at this moment that all members who had raised hands before do lower them so that we can note if there is any fresh hand on any matter so that we can continue. I see the hand of Honorable Hunsinger. Can we observe your hand and give you the platform?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me from the onset just congratulate you on your marginal victory of one vote as acting Chairperson. But Chairperson, I lost contact, unfortunately, while I was addressing the Chairperson in wanting to just offer my apology for Friday. I will not be able to attend the full session on Friday, but up to lunch, if that can just be noted. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hunsinger. Your request has been noted as such. Thank you very much. Colleagues, once more, thank you. The Chairperson had welcomed all of us. And once more, I welcome everybody. Today, I hope everybody is aware that we are dealing with the Transport Economic Regulator Bill. And today is our first day of taking public submissions which we have received. And all of us have received the copies of the submissions. And I hope that we have taken them to note and noted whatever we want to raise during the meeting. And at this point in time, if there is any other issue of clarity, I would call upon Valerie to introduce to us the first presenter and give us any rules that might be there, like time frames and so forth, because we would like to be as fair but as specific as possible. Valerie?
Yes, Mr. Mangu. The first presenters are from Uber. Mr. Kasim will introduce the rest of his team. He will be doing the presentation on behalf of Uber. The committee should be finished. There's enough time for the presentation and questions afterwards. The session has to be over with Uber by 10:30. We have our legal advisors in the meeting. If there are any further questions of clarity from the presentation, but the main focus is to hear what the presenters are saying today in terms of their submissions and to ask questions of clarity. After that, it will be bold from 10:30 till 12 o'clock, followed by Dr. Blackmer from 12 until around 1:30 today.
Thank you very much, colleagues. If I may also remind you that we did receive the program for today, and it should guide us so that we do not go over in terms of time. May I take the opportunity to welcome Mr. Kasim to take the floor, introduce the team, and go straight into the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, and all other attendees. Thank you very much for inviting us today to make submissions. With me today from Uber, apologies. First of all, to introduce myself. My name is Zinedine Kassim. and I am counsel for Uber in Sub-Saharan Africa. With me today is Ms. Suzanne Maharali, who is part of our policy team and in charge of EMEA. In charge of MIA. Also with me today is Ms. Lindy Wundler, who is Senior Counsel for Sub-Saharan Africa. Okay.
You are all welcome.
Thank you very much. If you would just bear with me a moment, I will now present my screen. Okay, thank you very much. Please let me know if you have any trouble seeing my screen, and please stop me while I go through my presentation if you have any questions, although I will leave some time at the end of our presentation for us to take questions. Okay.
Just to clarify, we will not take questions while you are presenting. We will take notes. And we'll allow you at the end if there's anyone of your team who would like to add on or anything, but we'll allow your presentation to flow.
Noted with thanks. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Okay. So thank you for the opportunity for allowing us to make these oral submissions to you today, to the committee. We have made submissions previously, and as noted by the chairperson, hopefully you have received our written submissions. But we would like to take the opportunity to thank you again for the opportunity. Okay, so our presentation today will be split up into six main agenda items. The first agenda item, I will be introducing Uber to the committee and to the attendees, just to give you some brief background as to our company and how we operate. Next, agenda item number two, I will speak to the bill in particular and its potential application. The third agenda item, I would like to speak to the concurrency of jurisdiction insofar as it relates to the regulator created by the bill. Next, I would like to speak with regard to price controls, which is one of the powers that the regulator is envisioned to have in terms of the bill. The fifth agenda item I'd like to speak to is access to information and how it is provided for in terms of the bill. And then I will, for the sixth agenda item, I'll just conclude our presentation, hopefully tying it all up together for the members. Okay. Okay, excuse me. So without any further ado, I will just jump into an introduction of Uber so that for the benefit of the committee members and all other attendees. Okay, so I'll speak to Uber generally in around the globe, just to give the committee a flavor as to our numbers, and we feel that this is the best way to introduce ourselves. So Uber is available throughout the globe. We're available in over 10,000 cities. We have 103 million active monthly riders globally. We're available in 69 countries across six continents across the globe. We have approximately 5 million active drivers globally who have completed 15 billion trips cumulatively from the time we began operations. And daily, we account for about 18 million rides on a daily basis. So that's just Uber in terms of the numbers globally. Locally in South Africa, Uber does about Uber has approximately 1 million active riders in South Africa. We have approximately 13,000 monthly active driver partners in South Africa as well. In South Africa, the trips that we have provided to riders have those riders have come from approximately 82 different nationalities. Okay. In terms of our footprint in South Africa, we're in the majority of major municipalities, including Buffalo City Municipality, Cape Town, Itsukweni, Ekurhuleni, Johannesburg, Makanda, Nelson Mandela Bay, Pietermaritzburg, Stellenbosch and surrounds, Tshwane, and the West Rand Municipality District. So you'll see from that we have quite a large footprint in South Africa. Okay. Before we go further, I thought it was important to just reiterate that that Uber is a technology company. So what this means is that we have a two-sided marketplace that allows drivers and riders to find one another. So the Uber app connects these riders and drivers at the touch of a button. So what is it that we provide to drivers? The Uber app. The Uber app provides flexibility, the ability of drivers to set their own hours, choose when and where to work, and increases the earning opportunity. We also try and promote safety and accountability. On the rider side, we provide reliability, affordability, transparency, accessibility. We promote safety, and we promote accountability. So I think that is important to note. Okay. I'm sure that most of the committee members, as well as the attendees today, may have used a ride-sharing platform or may have used Uber specifically. But just to give you a very brief overview as to how the platform works, the first is that a rider requests a trip using the Uber app. So they would open their app and request a trip. Uber sends that request to a driver partner who would be available. If they are available and they are willing to accept the trip, the driver would then accept that trip and pick up the rider and drop them off at their requested destination. Uber collects the fare from the rider on behalf of the driver. A trip receipt is issued on behalf of the driver to the rider at the end of each trip. Okay. So then at the end of the week, Uber aggregates the driver's fares and makes the payment to the driver based on all the trips that he had done for that week. The driver pays Uber a lead generation pays Uber for the lead generation service, and this is the service fee. And then Uber remits VAT on behalf of the driver to SARS. Okay. So that was just Uber generally and how we operate. So hopefully that is a good introduction. Now I would like to speak specifically to the bill. So the purpose for why we are here today. And I think the very first question that we had wanted to ask in our written submissions, I'm sure you have seen this, is what is the application of the bill? To whom does the bill apply? So taking a look at section 4.2 of the bill, the bill has quite a wide application. So it describes markets and entities to which the bill may apply. And from there, you can see that the bill has potential wide application with regard to the markets and entities. In this regard, we would just like to point out that where the bill is promulgated as an act and any regulations are promulgated as well, we would just ask that a one-size-fit-all approach does not apply. And the reason we say this is because of the different types of actors that are in the transportation, the transport sector. As you can imagine, there's a diverse nature, size, organizational structure, operational structure, and type of entities that operate in the transport sector. So I think it would be important that any legislation that is promulgated takes into account this diversity. The second point that we wanted to make with regard to the application of the bill is we note there 42A and 42B that the minister may consider how, to which entities the bill will apply based on, in terms of part A, whether the single operator controls more than 70% of the market concerned, or B, if preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the market. On this point, we would just like to reiterate that a proper that it would be important that a proper market definition occur here, and that that when the minister, in making his determination, ensures that the similar principles that have been applied, for example, by the Competition Commission in determining the market, that similar considerations be given there as well. Okay, moving on. The next agenda item that I wanted to speak about was with regards to concurrent jurisdiction. Okay, and this is the concurrent jurisdiction that is created in terms of the bill. Just very briefly, by way of introduction, the bill allows for concurrent jurisdictions for concurrent jurisdiction, in that it allows for instances in which two or more decision makers, for example, the regulator created in terms of the bill, or the Competition Commission, have the authority to decide on the same subject matter. So what the bill allows for is concurrent jurisdiction. However, in terms of the Competition Act, it is trite law that concurrent jurisdiction can only be exercised in certain circumstances. It is our contention that the bill improperly extends when the regulator and the commission, in terms of the Competition Act, may exercise concurrent jurisdiction. Okay, so what do I mean by this? Digging a little bit deeper. Okay, in terms of Section 2.4 of the bill, the bill presupposes concurrent jurisdiction. And why do I say that? I say that because, so Section 2.4 sets out what will happen where there's inconsistency between any provision of the bill and any provision of that of any other transport legislation. So it's quite clear in terms of the bill and transport legislation that where there's inconsistency, the bill will supersede such transport legislation. However, what Section 2.4 does not include there is the Competition Act. So what does this mean? This means that where there is any matter where the bill may speak to that particular matter, or the Competition Act speaks to that particular matter, the bill presupposes that both the regulator and the commission would have concurrent jurisdiction over that matter. Okay. Just to take a step back, I think it's important that we consider what are the requirements for concurrent jurisdiction. Because concurrent jurisdiction is not a new concept and has been spoken about and debated quite a bit in our law. And in terms of Section 3, subsection 1AB of the Competition Act, there are two requirements that must be met for there to be concurrent jurisdiction. The first is that the industry or sector must be subject to the jurisdiction of a regulatory authority. And this first requirement is definitely met by the bill because It creates a regulator whose jurisdiction is that of the transport sector, matters relating to the transport sector. So the first requirement is definitely satisfied. The second requirement is that the regulatory authority must have jurisdiction in respect of conduct regulated under Chapter 2 or Chapter 3 of the Competition Act. So Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 of the Competition Act speak of prohibited practices or merger control. And it is our contention that the second requirement is not met by the bill, is not satisfied. And we will give you two examples specifically in the bill where we believe that the second requirement is not met. Okay. So the first section that we want to speak to is section 4, subsection 4 of the bill, which speaks to whether or not the regulator has jurisdiction and making a determination on a particular matter. And what section 4 forces, and I've highlighted there at the bottom, so I'll just read it out for the sake of this presentation. When making a determination of section 4.2b, the regulator must have found that A, at least one firm operating in the market has market power, or B, a facility or resource in the market is an essential facility after having received and considered, and part two, a report from the market inquiry conducted by the regulator in terms of section 43.2b. I'd just like to pause on this particular point, which is section 4, subsection 4, B2, which allows for the regulator to conduct a market inquiry. So a market inquiry in terms of the Competition Act is contained in chapter 4A of the Competition Act. Now, if you recall, on my previous slide, I said that two requirements need to be met. The first is that a regulator must be created who has jurisdiction. And secondly, the regulator must exercise the power in terms of chapters 2 or 3 of the Competition Act. A market inquiry is in terms of chapter 4A of the Competition Act, and therefore not considered one of the powers in chapters 2 or 3. It is for this reason that there is an inconsistency between section four, subsection 4, and that of the Competition Act. So that is the first instance where the bill seeks to extend concurrent jurisdiction where it cannot. The second section where we can see this as well. Excuse me. Is in terms of section 45, subsection 1. And this again relates to the regulator having the ability to conduct a market inquiry. And as explained in my previous slide, market inquiries are not considered to be chapters 2 or 3 of the Competition Act. In fact, it's chapter 4A. And for that reason, the bill, again, seeks to extend concurrent jurisdiction where it cannot. So those are our contentions with regard to concurrent jurisdiction. The next agenda item that I'd like to speak to is with regard to price controls. So in this particular instance, I'd like to draw attention to section 9.2 of the bill, which speaks to the power of the regulator to impose price controls on a regulated entity. You'll recall from one of my earlier slides, the bill has a potential wide application. So a regulated entity, as considered in terms of this section 9.2, may include a number of different entities. And it is our contention that price controls undermine the economic concepts of supply and demand and pricing that's driven by market dynamics. which would have a detrimental effect on the market. And why do we say this? Okay. Speaking to e-hailing services in particular, so as I mentioned previously, e-hailing services operate in a two-sided market. So what does this mean? This means that we have, on the one hand, we have riders, and on the other hand, we have drivers. And for any e-hailing service to be successful, both sides of the marketplace must be attractive to drivers and riders. And of course, drivers and riders have competing interests. And when I say that, and what I mean by that is with regards to their fare, so the price of a trip. So riders, on the one hand, would want a fare that is low, as it increases affordability. On the other hand, we have drivers who would prefer to have fares higher. And the reason for this is the earning opportunity, and that dynamic is always at play. So what price controls do, in our opinion, is undermine this, a price is imposed which does not take into account market dynamics. And we believe that technology is better placed to ensure that this market dynamic is maintained as opposed to price control. Technology, as we have seen, is better able to respond to fluctuations on a real time basis. Then this is fluctuations with regard to demand and with regard to supply. So demand being on the rider side, supply being on the driver side. What's also important to note is that on the demand side, riders expect that the service they have provided is efficient. A rider wouldn't want to wait 30 minutes, for example, to be able to take a ride. And this is determined by how much supply there is. So we believe that dynamic pricing, which is a technology-driven solution, is better placed than price controls, which may be arbitrary. speaking of that as well, speaking of dynamic pricing in particular, we wanted to make a few points in this regard. First is that dynamic pricing has two effects. The first effect is that riders, so people who are looking for a ride, are not in a hurry to wait are not in a hurry until the price falls. Therefore, they reduce demand. And driver partners who are nearby are incentivized to go to a neighborhood which has higher fares, increasing supply. So what this means is that dynamic pricing will create a better balance in the marketplace, changing pricing based on supply and demand. And this ensures that there is efficiency, first of all, in the marketplace, but also cost effectiveness. And we believe that dynamic pricing is a better tool suited to ensure that these two objectives are met. So that's efficiency and affordability, as opposed to price controls. The second point that I wanted to speak to with regard to price controls is that price controls may be unconstitutional. In this regard, I would like to draw the members' attention to Section 22 of the Constitution, which states that every citizen has the right to choose their trade, occupation, or profession freely. The practice of a trade, occupation, or profession may be regulated by law. So I think in this regard, I would first like to start off by drawing attention to the S versus Lawrence case, which is a constitutional case. which speaks to the rights of freedom to trade, and in particular where the price controls are constitutional. So what was said in that case, and in a number of cases that have since followed, is that price controls may be regulated, and they may not infringe on the right to freedom of trade. However, price controls must be rational. And what do I mean by rational? I mean that the price control must be rationally related to the outcome the bill is seeking to achieve. Where the outcome that the bill is seeking to achieve is cost effectiveness for consumer and efficiency, as argued in my previous slides, price control may not be the best tool. So price control may not be rational, and we believe that dynamic pricing is a better tool in this regard. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. The last point that I wanted to speak to is with regard to access to information and the sections that the bill provides for this. Okay. And what do I mean exactly when I speak to access to information? I wanted to speak specifically to access to information in respect of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, or PIA. Okay, so Section 13 of the bill seeks to provide the regulator with a wide range of different powers in respect of requesting information, including confidential information, from a regulated entity. The point that we wanted to highlight here is that the Promotion of Access to Information Act already provides for such an instance. And what do I mean by such an instance? I mean requests for information made to both public and private bodies, including ourselves as a private body. So it already sets out a mechanism by which information is to be requested. So our ask here would be that Section 13 of the bill must be drafted in line with and must be subject to the relevant sections in PIA. Okay. Okay, it's at this point that I would just like to thank the chairperson and the committee members for having us and for allowing us the opportunity to present. I think at this point I would like to open up the floor if there are any questions. Both myself and my colleagues will try and answer those questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kasim, for your presentation and your excellent time management. However, the issue of opening the floor is our purview, not yours.
Oh.
On a lighter note, that's on a lighter note. But I'd like to invite maybe your colleagues, if there's anybody, or in Uber, once you have spoken, nobody else can speak after you, I don't know, to give them that opportunity before I go to my colleagues. Are you comfortable on your team? You don't need anybody to, and unmute yourself, please. You don't need anybody to add on just to give that opportunity?
No, I would like to give them the opportunity. It's my colleagues, okay. Cindy and Suzanne.
Colleagues
like.
From Uber, is there anything very, very burning that Mr. Kasim missed?
Nothing from me.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Nothing from me. I think Mr. Kasim summed it up beautifully.
Okay. Thank you. Last chance. Anybody from Uber? Then we go on. I'm sure there's nobody. Thank you very much once more, Mr. Kasim. And colleagues, there is the... presentation. I have noted Honorable Shabangu. Could I also see hands, because I know Honorable Shabangu's gadget doesn't give him an opportunity to raise hands. So I've noted his hand. I've noted Honorable McDonald. I have noted the Honorable Ramadwa, and I've all noted Honorable Hunsinger. Anybody else? Honorable Mabena? Anybody else, colleagues? All right, I'm sure you will have another bite. I will start straight with Honorable Shabangu. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Acting Chair. I've got a few chair. Acting Chair. I've got a few questions to ask. The first question is it Uber a registered company of South Africa? If yes, why is it given preference compared to other companies, especially in airports? Two, is Uber treating its drivers globally the same way in terms of benefits and salaries, taking into account trips that they have been taken? Three, prohibited practices can mean using roads that the regulator has not allowed you to use. Do you comply with this so as not to clash with other users, e.g. taxi organizations in South Africa? Last but not least, price controls. The price control of the trips is determined by kilometers to the destination. How do you control your technologies to take shortcuts or short routes to the destination? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shabangu. Straight, precise. Please, Mr. Kasim, you will note the questions, and then you will have an opportunity while all the members have responded. I hope you will note. And if there is any question not clear, you can ask the member to repeat it, please. I'll go straight to Honorable Lawrence McDonald.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation from Uber and my colleagues from the Portfolio Committee on Transport and all the members of the transport entity that's here. I only have a few comments and one or two questions, Chair. Can Mr. Kasim, please, he indicated that there's 13,000 driver partners in South Africa. How many of these drivers do actually own the cars, number one? And in the same question, how many of these 13,000 driver partners are South African citizens? Because he was quick to point out to us that under Section 22 of the Constitution, that every citizen has a right to his or her trade, but he has not, as most of us know, that none of these Uber drivers are South African citizens, number firstly, not that we are xenophobic or that, but Uber has in the last couple of years made a point of not employing South African citizens, and that is, to me, a big problem. Secondly, under price control and 9.2, on the percentage, what is the percentage of the money that Uber retains from each fare? Then under regulation of information, I can understand why they're concerned. But the information that they don't want to be in the public domain on how much money they're actually making and taking out of the country, when this country desperately needs for money, the money is running out of the country. Thank you, Chair. That is my submission.
Thank you very much, Honorable McD. The Honorable Ramadwa.
Mm-hmm.
Honorable.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity. Allow me to greet my colleagues and the staff from the
Honorable Ramadua, your reception is letting you down.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity that you have given me.
Stay
am
right
I audible?
There. Don't move now. Your reception
Chairperson,
is good.
Am I audible?
You are audible where you are. If you could just be constant, I'm sure you will be able to go through.
Okay.
Please,
Honorable Chairperson, thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'll do that. Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity, my colleagues and everybody. Chairperson, let me start by welcoming the presentation by Mr. Kazim from Uber. Chairperson, I want to check that he had mentioned when he was doing, he was making presentation and he started by introduction. Chairperson, he indicated that it's not Africa only. I just want to check with him, where is it controlled? Because it is an international brand. And then the cars of Uber are not regulated, and they are not designed as the same, because if it's global, it means my understanding was that it's going to be the cars also are going to be the same. And he indicated that this is a technology company. It means this is for where to do people, because in South Africa, we are having rural areas and urban areas. So now, seemingly, this is being used by well-to-do people, because they'll be using technology. Is that if they are using global standards, are these standards aligned? Because now I heard him quoting the Constitution. So is this global standards aligned to the Constitution of South Africa? Or they are quoting it, because some of the things that I want to submit for clarity, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much, colleague. Honorable Hunsinga, the time is yours.
Thank you, Acting Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Kasim, and the Uber team for studying the new economic regulation transport bill in this very early phases of development, but then also for taking time to prepare for this submission and to help us with input to consider toward development of this new bill. Mr. Kasim, in your presentation, specifically with regards to your remarks around prohibited practices, you make use of the Competition Commission Act 89 of 1998, but on the basis of the premise that there is a direct linkage. Now, what is this legal basis for combining the two, for even presenting it in a manner that you suggest that the Competition Commission or the Competition Act supersedes and components of the content of this Competition Act should override what is intended with the economic regulator bill. In the Competition Act, the Commission specifically has this anti-competitive conduct watchdog function, and I'm not entirely convinced that, as you argue, it would have application in terms of price control, because it is a discretionary power which the Competition Commission has. So what would you argue in contrary to my statement that I say, even though there is a particular intent to manage and regulate this anti-competitive conduct in the sense of prohibited practices and mergers, what would you say as a counter argument against the fact that it, to my thinking and to my understanding, is a discretionary one, even though there are specific references of that? Thank you also for the section that you presented on price control, and I have a direct question to you with regards to your price control. Is it within your capability to change trip prices without consulting anybody? Direct question, and I expect if you could just reply on that also in a direct way. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hunsinger. Honorable Mabena, it is your turn.
No, thank you so much, Chairperson, not acting Chairperson, Chairperson. thank you so much for the presentation. I think I would also want to venture into, I think there's a section that you're presenting in terms of the concurrent jurisdiction with regards to the Competition Commission Act, where you're saying that you see it, like for instance, I think on 3.8 on your submission, you're saying that, on 3.7, that the bill would bring in a situation where it will have a conflict with the concurrent jurisdiction provisions of the Commission Act. And we are alleging that the Commission can only have concurrent jurisdiction with another regulator in terms of its powers only under Section 2 and 3 of the Competition Act. Now, there's also one other venture into, and where we are saying that in the event where there is a conflict, the Competition Commission Act, the bill would then be in a position where it supersedes the Competition Commission Act. I think that's what you are alleging. But then, now, in that instance, the role of the Competition Commission essentially is to guard against malpractices of companies in terms of anti-competition behavior, which will then, in essence, protect consumers against unscrupulous and greedy companies with regards to behavior which is driven in the main by greed and profit. So one other issue which I think in relation to this one, you are saying you want the ministers to clarify to you in terms of what do they mean when they say 70% of the market. But in this instance, we're talking about e-hailing business. In the e-hailing sector, Uber in South Africa, you account for more than 70% of the market share of the business. And the bill says the minister has jurisdiction and has power in the event where a single player commands over 70% of the market share. Therefore, the minister can thus ensure that the act comes into play. In this instance, I think what you're trying to argue, you are trying to compare apples with oranges. For instance, you want to apply the entire market sector, where we are saying the market, the transport sector is quite broad and therefore it needs to be clarified. No, Here we're talking about the e-hailing business. Your submission, for instance, your company, you're a technology company, you are dealing specifically with e-hailing, and your submission is limited to e-hailing because that's your interest. That's where you're operating in. And in this case, we have a duty to ensure that we protect consumers because in this instance, in the e-hailing, you command over 70% of the market share in within this sector. So you asked the question there, and I want you to clarify what you were saying when you were asking that question, because in your presentation, you touched on that. And then I think in terms of price control and revenue, again, going back to the Competition Commission, many people use your app. You get into the app, get into the car. Somehow the car uses a different route and whatsoever. The price changes. If the price changes, isn't that anti-competitive behavior? Because now, I could have elected to use a different mode of transport. But when I'm standing there at the stop or wherever I am, and I weigh my options, from point A to point B, Uber will charge me 1 rand. From point A to point B, Bolt will charge me 1.20 rand. This one will charge, a taxi will cost me this much, this much, this much. And at that time, when I elect to use you and your technology, your company specifically, you came up and you presented yourself as the most reasonable one. And in the middle of my trip, anti-competitive here, because had you had given me an opportunity while I was still stationary at point A, I could have made an informed decision to say, okay, here are these companies competing for my business, competing for market share, and at this point in time, me being the consumer, I'm electing to use your services. So therefore, price control then comes into play. But also in terms of tax revenue, look, it is no secret. Any country which stands on tax revenue. What we're asking now is, yes, there are positive spin-offs which are there. People that buy these cars, they buy them from dealerships. As a result, they pay VAT, they pour petrol, there's a fuel levy there, and all of the other things when they go to service their cars and all of, and everything else. But Uber, as a technology company, what contribution are you making to the fiscal directly in this case, without you relying on the spin-offs which are there? For instance, what direct contribution you are making to the fiscal? And then also lastly, maybe this is unrelated, but in terms of safety, what safety measures and standards do you have? And how many incidents within South Africa? You're saying you're having almost 1 million trips a month. How many incidents have you had? And were those resolved? And to what extent were they? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, colleagues. If you may kindly drop your hands, I will highly appreciate it. Those who still have their hands up. Thank you very much, colleagues. Can I invite Mr. Kasim and the team? You have had the questions, others direct, others comments. If you could try the best you can to respond to these. I will give you guys till 9:15. It's about 9 minutes to respond, thereabout, if possible. Mr. Kasim and the team, over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. If it's okay, Mr. Kasim, I'd like to take these questions. Thank you very much, members.
You're welcome.
Questions. Thank you, Chair. We have a number of questions that have been asked. I'm going to try my best to do them justice during the limited time available. Please do forgive me if I do not address all your questions in full, but I am going to try to get to all the issues raised by the honorable members. I believe the first questions that were raised by the Honorable Chabangu The first question was, is Uber registered? Uber is indeed registered in South Africa. There is a company named Uber South Africa Technology Pty Limited. It's registered at the CIPC. It is in good standing. It is also in good standing in terms of its tax registration. So that is the status of Uber in South Africa. There is also another Uber entity for transparency called Uber BV, which is registered in the Netherlands, which also has operations in South Africa. I will give full disclosure relating to that entity in due course. Sorry, let me just push my phone off so that we are not distracted. Honorable Chabangu also asked if Uber is given preference. I'm afraid I'm not entirely certain what that question relates to, but if that question could be clarified in due course, we would be happy to respond to it. There was a further question relating to whether Uber treats drivers the same way globally regarding trips. Honorable members, you will appreciate that there are different regulations relating to the treatment of workers around the world. I will start off by saying that drivers with Uber are not employees of Uber. They're independent contractors, which means they work for themselves. That said, we do our best to ensure too that we comply with all applicable regulations in all the countries in which we operate. We are a company that seeks to apply by regulations, comply with regulations, which is why we find it very important to participate in all regulation-making systems, such as this one that we're participating in today. And to the best of our ability, we are complying with all regulations relating to drivers in South Africa. The regulations relating to drivers in South Africa versus relating to drivers in Nigeria, relating to drivers in Uganda, will necessarily be different, and therefore it is not going to be exactly the same treatment around the world. As you are aware, the standards relating to people in South Africa tend to be higher, and therefore we might have higher standards here compared to elsewhere around the world. The next question was relating to prohibited practices and do we comply, for instance, with relation to taxis. I would like to draw the attention of the committee to a decision made by the Transport Appeal Tribunal sitting in Cape Town. I'm afraid I do not recall the year. I believe it was 2016 or 2017. We are able to provide details of this if required. And the details of that were relating to how should Uber drivers and other rideshare drivers operate in the market. The decision of the Transport Appeal Tribunal at that time, which applies to all rideshare operators, was that in order for rideshare drivers slash operators to operate in South Africa, they need to apply for operating licenses under Section 66 of the NLTA, being the same requirements that apply to all other transport operators in taxi, that meter taxi. Therefore, and I can speak for Uber, in order for them to be onboarded onto Uber, they need to have applied for those documentations. Therefore, we are of the opinion that they are treated equally to taxi. Lastly, Mr. Chabangu asked about price controls and how it's determined with regards to the kilometers to the destination and how is the technology controlled. I think this will answer a number of questions that were asked by different members. The algorithm that is used to determine what the fare is for a rider who goes to a destination is determined by an upfront fare, which is a base fare, which is a flat rate which goes to the driver, usually approximately 25 rand. And then there is a time times distance component. Therefore, if it's going to take X minutes and Y kilometers to get to your destination, that is what will be charged to you in addition to the base fare. This can fluctuate at different moments. So for instance, if you encounter heavy traffic on the way and that leads to a significantly longer time to reach your destination, or alternatively, if you are in the vehicle and you ask the driver to take a different route to the one that was set out in the app, that might differ. However, all consumers have the opportunity to reach out via the help opportunity in the app to request that their fare be reviewed if the fare that they're ultimately charged does not align with the upfront fare that was set to them at the beginning of the trip. I hope that answers your question, Honorable Chabangu. I would like now to go on to the questions asked by the Honourable MacDonald. The Honourable MacDonald said that there are 13,000 active driver partners in South Africa and asked how many of them own the vehicles. I'm afraid we do not have that information available now. However, if you would like to seek further information on this, please do let us know and we can go back and dig in our archives for that information. Furthermore, the Honourable MacDonald asked how many are South Africans and would like to know how many of these are South African citizens. Firstly, I would like to highlight that the Constitution applies to all those living in South Africa, citizens and non-citizens, and that is the duty of our democracy. Secondly, I'd like to point out that all drivers who are onboarded onto Uber are required to obtain professional driver permits issued by the Department of Transport. We have full faith that the Department of Transport, in issuing these professional driver permits, ensures that all people who receive these documents are either South African citizens or have a right to work in South Africa. Therefore, we have full confidence that the department has already done that work in ensuring that everybody who is onboarded onto Uber has full authority to work in South Africa and has the full right to employment under the laws of the Constitution. Next question from the Honourable MacDonald was a question around the percentage of money that Uber retains from each fare. As we mentioned previously, there is a service fee that is applicable to the lead generation services. I will not specify the amount here as this is a public forum. However, we can provide this under confidentiality directly to the commission, if that's okay, to the sitting, if that's okay. However, what I will specify is that the vast majority of the funds raised as a result of e-hailing services through Uber in South Africa remains in South Africa. This is done in one of two ways. The first way is that the majority, the bulk of it, remains in the hands of drivers, as they are the individuals providing the transportation services, and therefore the bulk of the earnings remains with them. Uber does not provide transportation services, and therefore does not have a right to retain the majority of the earnings from the transportation services. That belongs to the drivers. They have done the work. They retain the money. It's their earnings. Secondly, Uber pays taxes in South Africa. As I mentioned before, Uber South Africa Technologies Inc. is registered for SARS and is in good standing in South Africa. Lastly, as from April 2019, the new tax requirements in South Africa held that where a foreign entity such as Uber BV provides technological services in South Africa, those technological services are subject to VAT. As Zainuddin Kassim mentioned in his presentation, Uber deducts those that VAT and remits it over to SARS. Therefore, Uber BV, even though it is an international entity, also remits VAT to SARS and is in good standing with SARS and has a certificate to that effect. I'd like to pause there to just check if my colleagues have any comments before I move on to the questions by Honourable Member Amadwa.
Nothing further, Lindy. Please go on.
Thank you. Honourable Ramadwa then asked where Uber is controlled because it's an international company. Uber has a, as I mentioned, a branch in the Netherlands called Uber BV, and therefore the technology that is provided in South Africa is provided from the Netherlands. However, as you can, well, you cannot see because we're on Zoom, I sit in Johannesburg supporting South Africa and the rest of Sub-Saharan Africa. Zainuddin also sits in South Africa supporting South Africa. Suzanne, I believe, is sitting, Ms. Maharali, is sitting in our Johannesburg office right now. We have a full complement of staff making sure that we are able to support the South African business from South Africa, ensuring that we have South Africans and local people providing the very best support we can to our local services. The next question was whether the cars of Uber are the same globally. No, they're not. because we have different cars available around the world and different availability of vehicles. Therefore, for instance, if you go to Kenya, one of the countries on the continent in which you operate, the majority of the vehicles are small cars, small hatchbacks, which we do not have operating in South Africa. And in South Africa, we have mostly sedan vehicles because that is what the South African market requires. Therefore, we need to make sure that we service the needs of the people locally. On a side note, for instance, if you go to the United States, I personally am always rather disappointed by the vehicles they have there because they tend to be rather dirty as opposed to the vehicles that we have in South Africa. So personally, I prefer the Uber service that we have in South Africa. The last question was around this being a technology company and the question around rural versus urban. Now, on this, I'm going to speak on a personal note because as I was saying to some colleagues of mine yesterday, it's a great passion of mine that we should be able to support and grow Africa as a company, and that is what I really drive to do. However, at the same time, we're a business. So what I would love to see is for us to be able to grow this business and to provide opportunities to people all around the continent. That said, what we have seen since Uber started up in South Africa is an increase of opportunity from the main centers in cities such as Johannesburg and Cape Town to an expansion of transportation services to areas that were previously underserved. Therefore, if you see where demand was coming from previously, in Joburg it used to be places like Sandton, Rosebank, Parktown and places like that. And now the demand is coming from places like Soweto and Tembisa and the West Rand, which previously did not have access to transportation services as much as before. So we might not yet be giving opportunities to rural consumers. However, we are slowly but surely expanding the net of consumers who are able to access transportation services. Next, I'd like to go on to the questions by the Honorable Hunslinger, speaking to prohibitive practices in relation to the Competition Commission and the direct linkage between the two, and asking what the legal basis for combining the two is. And specifically how the Competition Commission supersedes this act or this bill. Now, I would like to turn specifically to the advent of the Competition Commission in around 1999-2000, where specifically there was a question of the concurrent jurisdiction of the Act with the operations of ICASA. And I'm not sure if you recall that time in the jurisprudence of the Competition Commission, but through a number of cases and a number of through the jurisprudence that was developed then, what was found was where there is a regulator that is specifically appointed to regulate a specific area of the law. In this case, the Competition Commission has been created to regulate price and price controls. And there is a question of concurrent jurisdiction, the specific agency is the one that gets precedence over the other. So in this case, it did not work in the favor of the Competition Commission because ICASA was the one that was specifically mandated to deal with broadcasting. And therefore, ICASA is the one that got precedence in this case. And if I'm not mistaken, please do correct me if I am mistaken, what subsequently happened was in the, I believe, 2006-2007 of the Competition Act, they then amended the provisions of the Act to put in these specific provisions that Mr. Kassim spoke of to specify which clauses of this Competition Act would gain precedence in the event of concurrent jurisdiction. And for that reason, I would argue that where we have a conflict of jurisdiction between the two, where the Competition Commission specifically speaks to them, and actually pulled out my act to look it up, the commission would gain precedence here. The next question was on price control. Is it within Uber's capability to change prices without consulting anyone? You wanted a blunt answer? Yes. The same way it's possible for ShopRite to change the price of tomatoes without consulting you. The same way it's possible for Woolworths to change the price of chicken without consulting you. But you know what? We do consult. We hold roundtables with drivers. We have weekly surveys with drivers to check what their satisfaction is, and we look at measures such as what the price of fuel is, what the changes are, to ensure that we are acting as responsible citizens. However, that does not change the fact that any commercial entity in the country has the authority to change prices as they so deem. Enough time. I know I'm over time. The first question was around concurrent jurisdiction and the conflicts around Section 2 and Section 3 of the Competition Act. I believe that has already been answered. The next question was around the authority of the regulator to set regulations where any entity controls more than 70% of the market. He quite boldly declared that Uber controls more than 70% of the market. I'm sure our bosses would love to hear that. I'm sure our friends from Bolt, who are also on the call, would disagree with that. All we are saying in this respect is that it is important to hold a inquiry and to hold a proper evaluation to ensure that we are properly and accurately and using proper economic evidence, calculating those market shares properly. We're not saying that this is a provision that needs to be struck out from the bill. We're not saying that the regulator should not have that authority. All we're saying is that this needs to be evaluated very carefully with proper economic evidence, and the Competition Commission in its 20-something years of existence has developed the tools to be able to do this, and we would like to be able to rely on that. The Honourable Member also mentioned that our submission is limited to e-hailing. Yes, it is, because we are in the e-hailing business, and that is what we understand, and we cannot presume to speak on behalf of other market participants. However, we would be very happy to hear submissions from other market participants as to how they see this bill. On the question of price control and revenue, the Honourable Member asked about what happens when there's a different route. I think I answered that question right at the beginning about how fares are determined in respect of a base fare and time times distance. I would also like to point out that the Honourable Member specifically said that he could have chosen to have taken a different mode of transport, including Bolt or taxi. And I welcome that in saying that that I think would be very welcome in the submissions to the regulator in determining what the market is, because the Honourable Member did say that taxi, I believe minibus taxi, would be a competitor to e-hailing services. Lastly, there was the question of tax revenue. As I mentioned to you, both Uber entities that have operations in South Africa are contributing to the tax base. And lastly, the question was around safety measures and safety standards and how many incidents there were in South Africa. I'm afraid we do not have details about the number of safety incidents in South Africa and how they were resolved, as we were not prepared for that question when we came to this meeting today. However, I'd like to highlight for you really quickly what the safety measures and standards were. As mentioned previously, all drivers who are onboarded onto Uber need to have a PRDP, which includes a background check, as you are well aware. In addition to that, there are third-party background checks to make sure that no individual onboarded onto Uber has a criminal record. We have a number of measures, including making sure that before a driver onboards, they need to take a selfie which compares their face ID to ensure that it's the same driver who was onboarded onto Uber. We have two-factor identification. At random opportunities, a driver is required to verify their identity before they can take a trip. We have a law enforcement liaison system that makes sure that we are able to react swiftly and regularly to incidents if reported, and we liaise very closely with the SAPS. Our liaison is a former SAPS member himself, has very close connections. Safety is our top priority, and we try to ensure that we keep that top of mind. We don't always get everything right. Unfortunately, we do live in a country where we are still trying to figure some things out due to our history of violence, but we are working together with various individuals, including the law enforcement officials, to try and get it right. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Chair.
All right. I apologize. It's not an e-hailing issue here. It was just a matter of me not having unmuted. My humblest apologies. So I was thanking Ms. Vunda for the responses. And I do know that we could have had a lot of follow-up questions. However, I think the time we have spent is really good. We will follow up any other process that we might need through our processes. But I would like to take this opportunity to thank Uber for having taken keen interest in our processes and having come to answer to all our questions. And we truly appreciate it, because our purpose is really to enrich our process, and it's through these interactions, excuse me, that we are able to enrich this process. So on that note, I would like to say once more, thank you so much. Colleagues, thank you very much. We have caught up time. We had started a bit late with the presentation, but I'm sure with the following ones, we will stick to time. And I would then, at this point in time, release those who are from Uber. But as you know, this is a public platform. You are more than welcome, should you still want to continue being part of this. But if you are done and you want to be released, you are released. Thank you once more. We appreciate your time taken to come and meet the committee. And at this point in time, we will immediately go straight to Bolt, whom I believe are already here. I don't have the name of who is leading the delegation, but I will immediately, at this time, it's 10:29, that you immediately come in. Let us know who you are, and then we will approach it exactly the same way. You will complete your presentation. Thereafter, the honorable members will have an opportunity to ask you questions. You will respond, and we'll see how the time goes. Over to you.
Good morning, honorable chairperson and honorable members of the portfolio committee. My name is Gareth Taylor. I am the country manager for Bolt in South Africa, and I will be beginning this presentation this morning. I'm accompanied on today's virtual platform hearings by our policy and regulatory advisors, Ms. Misal Jaffe and Mr. Abdul Wahid Patel. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to engage you on Bolt South Africa's submission on the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill. As a leading platform enabling safe, efficient and affordable public transport, and which creates significant earning opportunities for drivers, this bill in its current form will have a significantly detrimental impact on the beneficiaries of these services in South Africa. Therefore, we place great importance on today's engagement with you so that together we can ensure that by improving the provisions contained in this bill, we continue to leverage digitization to enhance public transport's role in the country's economic construction and recovery. Based on the guidelines provided by the committee and our written submission, our presentation today will cover these topics that you can see. We'll start with a brief introduction to Bolt in South Africa. I'll then hand over to Mr. Michelle Jaffe, one of our policy and regulatory advisors, who will continue to present to Bolt submission. She will speak to the impact of the bill, comments and recommendations, before handing over to me for the concluding remarks. This is a picture of our CEO and co-founder, Mr. Marcus Willig, who started the company when he was just 19 from a country called Estonia. For those of you interested, he's now 26. Bolt is a technology company and a platform that connects drivers and passengers to meet the growing demand of commuters seeking reliable, safe, and affordable access to transport in towns and cities across South Africa. Today, Bolt operates globally in over 35 countries, connecting more than 30 million passengers with over 500,000 drivers. In South Africa, Bolt has a presence in more than 33 cities and towns in all 9 provinces. Currently, we are present in 7 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and we are the largest e-hailing platform in 2 of those markets. In South Africa, we are aware of the environmental cost of transportation. In SA, more than 30% of household income is spent on transport. And according to a 2017 study of the 10 most congested countries in the world, South Africans spend 36 hours per week in peak congestion. 30% of global carbon emissions are from transportation. And this is why Bolt plans to bring more electric vehicles and scooters to our platform to offer greener ways to move in cities offices around the world by 100% in 2020. Further Cabinet-approved green transport strategy, Bolt is committed to providing a world-class transport system that reduces both the cost of transport and the quantity of greenhouse gases that are emitted by the sector. Our research indicates that currently around 2% of all urban trips are completed on e-hailing platforms in South Africa. And according to the research that we've done, this is likely to increase to up to 28% of all trips by 2028. In South Africa, 1 in 5 people own their own car. So on-demand and integrated transport is the future. On-demand transport will grow as a result of 3 main factors: ride-sharing, pooling, and people generally preferring mobility as a service as opposed to owning their own and having to maintain their own car. So moving on to while being a relatively new mode of land-based transport in South Africa, e-hailing services are now firmly part of the public transport ecosystem. The distinct provisions for e-hailing in the National Land Transport Amendment Bill passed by this portfolio committee is recognition of this. It is therefore important that the further regulation of e-hailing services through legislative measures such as this bill must be informed by an appropriate understanding of the service, and thus how to regulate for it in the interest of commuters and drivers. Economic policy in South Africa, such as the recently published National Treasury paper, Economic Transformation, Inclusive Growth, and Competitiveness towards an Economic Strategy for South Africa, recognizes the catalytic role of e-hailing services. It further recommends that government must create an enabling and appropriate regulatory environment to leverage e-hailing services for socio-economic growth. I'll now hand over to Ms. Wissel Juppie, one of our policy and regulatory advisors, who will continue to present on Bolt's submission on the economic regulation of transport bill.
Thank you very much, Gareth, and good morning, honorable members. Bolt would just like to reiterate its support for the National Land Transport Amendment Bill. Bolt considers this an important inclusion and provision in the regulation to provide for appropriate legislative provisioning and the regulatory certainty for e-hailing services in South Africa. The enactment of this bill will result in much needed clarity regarding the regulation of e-hailing services in South Africa and also contribute to alleviating many of the challenges operators are currently facing, but also provide an effective and appropriate regulatory licensing and administrative compliance and enforcement environment for road-based land transport, of which Bolt remains a part of the subsector and ecosystem. The bill will also enable the minister to put in place certain regulations specific for e-hailing services, which are already provided for in the bill and do not need to be addressed in other legislation such as this bill. I'd now like to just focus on a few introductory remarks. Bolt is committed to being an active contributor to the development of an efficient and cost-effective transport system in South Africa, which supports economic and social development. This is consistent with the purpose of the bill, which we support. Regulatory inconsistency and fragmentation, however, creates inefficiencies and results in the inability to deliver affordable and accessible transport services which facilitate economic inclusion and participation. Bolt considers this an important to move on to the rationale. The gaps in the regulatory environment inhibit government's ability to leverage the public transport ecosystem, including ensuring efficiency and access and affordability for all. The introduction of pricing control is premature in the absence of addressing the regulatory barriers. Pricing control interventions will negatively impact on the provision and access of e-hailing services and impede innovation in the transport and mobility sector. We therefore do not support price regulation, as we believe that this stifles the benefits arising from digital platforms and digital innovation in transport, which has been beneficial to drivers, passengers, and competitive market dynamics. It creates barriers to entry and access, including impacting negatively on the sustainability thereof. I will now focus on specific provisions in the bill and our comments and recommendations thereon. Our written submission, which all members will have, and our presentation today includes all relevant sections and clauses of the bill which are of concern to Bolt South Africa. This includes our recommendations on each of the sections that have a material impact on the bill. However, for the purposes of this presentation and our allocated time, I will focus on the following sections and clauses in the bill in particular, and I wish to draw the committee's attention to these specifically. We are, of course, happy to address any other section and clause reference in our presentation and our detailed submission at the committee's request. I will go through each of these sections very briefly. In respect of the determination and of price controls, we are of the view that Section 11 is far-reaching and intrusive, and its application to e-hailing should be excluded. It directly intervenes in the operations and business models of independent transport services such as e-hailing platform providers, and that has a substantive impact on the users of the platform, which are the drivers and the passengers. We also wish to draw the committee's attention to the Competition Commission's Public Passenger Transport Market Inquiry's provisional report on e-hailing services, which was published in February 2020, which stated that the welfare-enhancing benefits arising from digital platforms and their network externalities must be encouraged and preserved to the extent that they are not leading to competition distortions. Furthermore, the competition also stated that price regulation and the regulation of prices seems to introduce administrative burdens for authorities, and it is inflexible to address changing market dynamics. Price regulation in general acts as a disincentive for innovation. We therefore do not support the introduction of price regulation, as it will distort the market dynamics, be disadvantageous for consumers as well as players in the market, given that the South African market is developing and growing with the entry of new participants. For all stakeholders, it is advantageous that the principle of market dynamics be applied, and thus natural forces, including supply and demand, would regulate the system, with the additional benefit of consumers being made aware of the price points and fully entitled to accept or decline the price and the trip. If price controls are to be introduced and to take effect, we are of the view that e-hailing should be excluded and exempted from the application of Section 11 in this bill. In respect of the extraordinary review of price controls, if price controls are introduced and are taken into effect, this must be subject to regularized oversight and review at set periods of time or applicable timeframes. We therefore propose that this must be reviewed every 90 days as a maximum, and a review may be conducted at any time at the request of an entity, service, or sector directly affected by such price regulation. I will now move on to the clauses relating to confidentiality and the disclosure of information. We are of the view that Section 13 is unduly broad and open-ended, as it empowers the regulator to request information which is business and operation specific and sensitive. The nature and the type of the information requested is also far-reaching, and at present it is unclear as to the rationale in support of the disclosure and request of this information. A clear criteria and parameters must be set for the type of information which may be requested from independent businesses and services that are not state-owned. The same would apply for Section 13.2, which is also open-ended and empowers the regulator unreservedly with intrusive and extensive authority regarding confidential information which infringes on the rights of independent businesses. In respect of Section 14, is of the view that this section should only apply to state-owned entities, as these entities are already under the jurisdiction of the state and regularly report and disclose relevant information. Furthermore, we'd like to reiterate that independent businesses and services within the transport service sector must maintain their autonomy unconditionally and must be exempt from the application and compliance of this section. In respect of Section 60, we are of the view that the regulator must uphold confidentiality of the information shared with them at all times, and it should not be at their discretion to determine whether or not such information deems to be confidential. All information that is shared should be subject to confidentiality agreements entered between the parties, and any written statements must be upheld. Therefore, we are of the view that the regulator cannot dispute the basis for confidentiality and must at all times maintain the confidentiality of the information shared. I will now move on to the role of the Competition Commission in respect of the functions of the regulator. In terms of Section 21, Fault is of the view that Section 21 endows the regulator with extensive and discretionary powers to introduce reductions in price control per the circumstances identified in Section 18E, 19.2, and 20.5.B, and this is in the absence of receiving and considering an opinion from the Competition Commission during the process of determining an appropriate reduction. We have the view that the publication of the imposition of a reduction is insufficient, and the regulator must publish a notice of intent to introduce the imposition prior to such being given effect to and implemented. We therefore propose that this section be amended to enable the Competition Commission to provide an opinion to the regulator on any potential effect on the market, as well as afford written and verbal pleadings from interested and affected stakeholders and third parties. Furthermore, an appropriate consultation period and process prior to any imposition of an adjustment in pricing should be taken into account and should be provided for. In respect of Section 30, that also deals with the functions of the regulator, we are of the view that the functions per subsection 38F and 38G are unnecessary. These functions should be executed by the Competition Commission upon the direction of the regulator. The Competition Commission is best placed to conduct research regarding market structure and service delivery, and whether or not entities, markets, facilities, and services within the transport sector are functioning competitively. This includes the ability to conduct market inquiries. The Competition Commission should then provide a report and recommendations then to the regulator for consideration and final determination. Therefore, subsections 38F and 38G should be deleted. Furthermore, subsection 38H should not empower the regulator to determine methods of price regulation, which also remains unqualified and undefined in the bill. This should not be introduced or determined by the regulator, as it is already empowered to determine price controls and reductions. In respect of the relations with the regulatory authorities, and specifically as it relates to the Competition Commission, the Competition Commission is best placed to execute these activities per the direction of the regulator as it relates to competition and market conduct as provided for in the Competition Act. Therefore, the clause must be amended to enable the regulator to request the Competition Commission to conduct a market inquiry on competition-related matters or competition concerns in the market. We would also like to iterate in respect of subsection 43.4 that we reiterate the Competition Commission is best placed to conduct a market inquiry and the regulator should be enabled to direct and request such from the Commission. Therefore, the clause must be amended to provide the regulator to request the Commission to conduct the inquiry on behalf of the regulator. In respect of the consultation processes, these clauses we have identified which require strengthening in terms of providing an adequate consultation period and time frame for stakeholders to comment on the functions and powers of the regulator and its mandate in the execution thereof. In respect of the general provisions, we note that it is important for the regulator to be kept appraised of regional and international developments in the field of economic regulation. We support this function specifically in the case of nascent sectors like the e-hailing sector, which is especially important when considering and prior to implementing any interventions. Therefore, consultation is critical, and we propose that an amendment to the clause being given effect to enable the regulator to consult regulated entities, facilities, services, or sectors with regard to any matter which may directly affect their functions and operations. In respect of Clause 40 and the development of codes of practice, BALT notes the importance of developing and promoting codes of practice. However, these cannot be developed in the absence of receiving input from and without consulting the relevant services and sectors. Therefore, consultation must be mandatory and specifically provided for in the clause as outlined in our recommendations. Regarding section 43.3, we are of the view that 20 business days are insufficient of a time frame to serve notice in terms of the commencement of a market inquiry. Therefore, the clause should be amended to provide at least a 30-day notice period before the commencement of market inquiry. In respect of subsection 46.8, we are of the view that the regulator must publish a draft report on the inquiry in the Government Gazette for public comment and consultation prior to the final report being published must be undertaken. Therefore, we recommend that the clause is amended to provide for the publication of a preliminary report for consultation for a period of no less than 30 business days to allow stakeholders to appropriately input on that and towards the finalization of a final report which may then be gazetted in the Government Gazette. Regarding subsection 51.2 and 51.2b, the provision for consultation and determining the annual fee to be paid by the regulator is open-ended and vague and absent on the applicable process to guide the consideration and implementation thereof. The evidence base and information used to determine and implement different fees is also absent. Consultation is required prior to the imposition of any fees. This clause must also include an appropriate consultation process, which we have set out, as publication of the intention to introduce in order to enable a minimum of 30 business days for stakeholder comment due to the impact and the nature of the intervention proposed. In respect of the promotion of legislative and regulatory reform, the powers that are currently afforded to the regulator in this regard should not reside with the regulator, as it is already a function of the Department of Transport. Extending such powers to the regulator would then conflict with and be a duplication of existing responsibilities and programs of the department, and will also impact on the existing regulatory functions of provincial entities and municipalities regulating transport in their respective jurisdictions. It is also inappropriate to empower the regulator to review legislation and regulation and make further recommendations in respect of legislative and regulatory reform, as this is especially concerning where the legislation regulation predates the enactment of this bill as well as the regulator. We therefore propose that subsection 41B, 40.1C and 41.2 is deleted and removed entirely. I'll now focus briefly on the annual fees as provided for in section 50 and section 51 of the bill. Balt is of the view that the regulator does not engage in any regulatory activities such as the consideration, adjudication, and issuances of licenses for entities, facilities, services, or sectors. Therefore, there is no reason for introducing annual fees, and what such fees may be used for and subsidized is equally unclear. Any consideration to introduce annual fees to be paid by regulated entities must be subject to consultations with the directly affected entities, facilities, and services, as well as sectors. Such cannot be introduced in the absence of an appropriate information and evidence base. We therefore propose that the introduction of annual fees should only be applicable to state-owned entities, facilities, and services. Furthermore, e-hailing services must be exempt from the application. In respect of section 51, as it relates to the minister's determination of annual fees to be paid by regulated entities, we are of the view that regulated entities should not be the cost of the regulator and the council. As we have previously stated, the regulator does not engage in regulatory activities, and it remains unclear as to the rationale for imposing annual fees. The rationale for introducing annual fees is also, as previously stated, unclear, and what this may be used for is neither stipulated nor defined in the bill either. Balt therefore submits that the introduction of the annual fees may only be applicable to state-owned entities and that e-hailing services remain exempt from this application. In respect of section 54, and this specifically relates to the powers afforded to the minister to introduce regulations, Balt is of the view that the provisions afforded to the minister are too broad and open-ended in terms of the discretionary powers to make regulations which have not been defined or qualified. We therefore are of the view that these need to be stipulated and set out specifically in the report. I'll now hand over to Gareth for the concluding remarks.
Thank you, Rissel. In concluding, I'd like to highlight and reaffirm a few critical points for Balt in respect of this bill. In the interest of maintaining a competitive market that promotes innovation in South Africa's nascent e-hailing sector, we conclude with the following recommendations to the Portfolio Committee. Firstly, we call on the committee to recognize that Balt as an e-hailing technology and innovation enables cost-effective and efficient public transport, despite the prevailing regulatory shortcomings. That the provisions pertaining to intervention in respect of pricing should be excluded and its applicability should not extend to e-hailing services. This is evidenced by consumers having total transparency on the applicable price before confirming a journey, with the ability to voluntarily accept, reject, or cancel in real time. Thus, any new regulatory measures should not undo these consumer gains or the earnings potential of drivers. Price regulation in this nascent stage in the development of the South African e-hailing market would inhibit market entry for new participants and would introduce administrative burdens for authorities. The bill is duplicitous to the existing role and powers of the provincial and municipal regulatory authorities in regulating e-hailing services, should undermine their autonomy and intergovernmental relations. Currently, South Africa faces severe fiscal constraints to higher levels of public transport investment. By leveraging digitization and mobility, we are contributing to the transformation of public transport and its role in inclusive economic growth. E-hailing services platforms such as Bolt already enable this by connecting drivers with passengers to meet the growing demand of commuters seeking reliable, safe, and affordable access to transport in towns and cities across South Africa. Therefore, this bill should not be rushed without scrutinizing the policy harmonization and regulatory approach to ensure that it is appropriate to each land-based mode of public transport, including e-hailing services. Therefore, Balt requests the Portfolio Committee to consider our inputs. We remain available to the Portfolio Committee as a resource and look forward to the opportunity to engage with you further. We wish the Portfolio Committee well during the remainder of these hearings and the deliberations that lie ahead. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee, for this opportunity to present our comments on the bill. We're happy to take any questions from the committee and also revert in writing to the committee on matters which we may not be able or be in a position to address offhand at this time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Taylor and Ms. Chappie, for the comprehensive submission. And once more, we appreciate your time you have taken and showing interest in the processes of government and parliament in particular. Honorable members, Balt has done their portion, and now it is us who must raise our comments, our questions. And thereafter, Mr. Taylor, Ms. Yapi, I would request that you take notes of all the questions. We will take all questions at the same time, and we'll give you an opportunity once more to respond. And honorable members, the platform is yours. If I could see by show of hands, who are the takers on this presentation? It appears that, okay, there we go. Honorable Hunsinger, you are number one. Honorable members, who else? Going. Oh, all right. Honorable Hunsinger is number one. Honorable Mabena is number two this time, not number last. Honorable Miriam Ramadwa will follow after Honorable Mabena. Honorable Noluchungu, you are most welcome. You will follow after Honorable Ramadwa. Your hand up, Honorable Shabang. Honorable Shabangu will come after Honorable Noluchungu. And last but not least, Honorable McDonald will be the last one. Have I not missed anybody? I think I have not missed anybody. Can I repeat, colleagues? It will be Honorable Hunsinger goes first, followed by Honorable Mabena, followed by Honorable Ramadwa, by Honorable Noluchungu, Honorable Shabangu, and Honorable McDonald. If we will just follow in that order without me asking you and wasting more time. Honorable Hunsinger, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Taylor and Madam Jappy. It remains difficult for us to balance the objective with certain realities, certain participants, in particular the sector of e-hailing. Now, in February this year, the Competition Commission released a particular report following a investigation upon complaints from the meter taxi, and it was the meter taxi e-hailing services report, to quote the title of the report, which I, as I mentioned, was released in February, the 19th of February this year. And if you look at the recommendations of this particular report, specifically, it was the Competitions Commission that recommended to the Department of Transport price setting mechanisms. Now, both from yourselves and your competitor Uber, we have heard a lot of what we shouldn't do in terms of price control, hence the sentiment for a free market and open competition environment, but very little recognition for the dilemma which we currently have in the transport sector, which leaves me a bit disappointed, because as a participant, I would have expected a positive input from your side about how this particular environment can be improved. However, the impression now after getting the second presentation of the same category of participant, namely e-hailing, it's all about don't try to get to us. Don't try to control us, rather than to, in a positive way and with the knowledge of the local environment, give us an indication of where we should go. So, yes, it's price control versus market control, but then the dilemma and the current status is that of stakeholder and participation. Competition to the extent that people are killed. And that is how serious the market share and the solution desire is for this particular area. And I would have expected a lot more focused share of ideas and solutions also from your side. Nevertheless, operating licenses remain the conventional way in which this environment is attempted by government to be regulated. Could you then, in a reply to the remarks that I made, give us an impression of your idea about how would and what should be the regulators, if in your argument not price, and also you constantly steering away from taking up, you know, anything around operating licenses, In what other way can the current public transport, e-hailing, meter taxi, normal taxi, how can, what mechanisms and how would you then recommend we regulate this environment? Thank you, Chair.
Let us flow, colleagues. Thank you, Honorable Hunsinger, Honorable Mabena.
No, thank you so much, Chairperson. Thank you again for the opportunity. Look, I think in as far as the presentation is concerned, like, it would be safe to say that Uber and e-hailing are almost terrified of being regulated by government. And I think they are the issue here emanates from the issues of price control. On the issue of the notice from in terms of section 43, subsection 3 of 20 business days, and the recommendation that it must be at least 30 business days, it isn't a problem for a market inquiry. It isn't a problem, and I think that's something that perhaps the committee can be amenable to entertain. However, on the issue where Bolt says that the regulator might want information which is, one, business related and business specific and sensitive, and that they want a situation where the protection of information should be guaranteed. Yes, obviously, the regulator must ensure that the information that it shares or that it gets from the companies is protected. And I think protection of information is essential, especially for the functioning of the state. But where perhaps I disagree is to try and impose a limitation on what the regulator can request from the company. You can't say that it is open-ended. The regulator should be in a position to request any information whatsoever that would be essential for them to achieve what they want to achieve. In as such, for them to be able to perform their duties of being a regulator in the sector and in the space. So in that instance, I would say then and submit to say the issues of 20 days, 30 days, absolutely no problem. The issues of the information being requested by the regulator, there shouldn't be any limitation whatsoever. Even if whatever type of information that they would want, they should be able to provide to the regulator. And what the regulator does with the information, obviously, for the purposes of what they want to achieve, which we always believe that the regulator will be acting in the best interest of citizens and consumers. But they also obviously will have to protect the information. But I think in the main, Chair, the submission of Bolt and that one of Uber is almost the same. They're both fighting from the same corner, fighting against the regulation and also against price controls. So yeah, but I think we obviously still in the early stages of the development of the bill. There's still a long journey and process from this point onwards, but we'll take it from there. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, colleague. Honorable Ramadwa.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Let me start by welcoming the presentation. Honorable Chairperson, I also want to speak on the issue of price, which was mentioned by the presenter. They don't want to be regulated because my understanding is that they don't want to be regulated because theirs is to look at the profit. They don't think of consumers and the situation that we find ourselves in. I think it's something that they must think of because they don't want the regulator to come in. whereas the regulator is there to make sure of everybody in the country, not necessarily the certain people. My second submission, Chairperson, is on the issue that they have raised in their presentation of efficient and cost-effective transport. When they are saying that, I'm still saying they are looking at their profit, but how do they manage the issue of safety to the consumers or riders? I'm raising this because every now and then we'll be hearing stories concerning the Bolt. And the other issue is what I have asked in the previous presentation here, Uber. Where are they controlled? Thank you, Chairperson. That's my submission.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ramadwa. Honorable Nolu Chungu.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the board representatives for the presentation. Chair, I think today we have had presentation from people who are profit driven. You speak of an affordable public transport system, and yet you are against price control. It cannot be that you want to be exempted from price control, because it is the role of the government to provide an affordable public transport system, and therefore they have to look after the commuters. It will be as if the former speaker, Honorable Ramadwa, was reading my mind that, you know, we've had a lot of safety incidents on Bolt that have been reported. If you can please clarify on us, what are the safety measures that you've put in place? Thirdly, your prices are almost 50% less than that of Uber. How do you manage that? And how do you determine, you know, your prices? What is a kilometer? What is the price for a kilometer? And how much goes to the drivers? I think that is all for now. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Shabangu.
Thank you, Chair. I think my colleagues have said all that I wanted to say, except to say, according to my understanding, the Bolt company is out of order. They only want to take the fair share of the cake and leave South Africans with poverty. They are just interested in getting richer and richer, and they don't want to be controlled. That is the comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shabangu. Honorable McDonald, you are the last one on this round.
Thank you, Chair. I would also like to thank Bolt for their presentation. I do want to make some comments. Their presentation was, in essence, just about the same as Uber. They don't want regulation for many reasons, mostly because the drivers don't own their vehicles. The drivers are paying exorbitant fees to white monopoly capitalists to own the vehicles. The drivers have got no protection because it's on the same basis as labor brokers. And that's what the Transport Committee has been trying to legislate and to formalize the taxi industry to bring protection for these drivers. And we are now being asked not to include them into this regulatory bill regarding because they don't want some of the information to be out there. But I think that that's not fair that they treat ordinary South Africans like that. in such a fashion that it's all about money and not about the people of South Africa. There's no difference in the way that they do their business. They are just cheaper. And it can be seen in the quality of their vehicles. It can be seen in the quality of their service. And they do exactly the same things. They don't employ South African drivers. The money goes out of the country. And I'm very concerned, Chairperson, that this is just another way of trying to stop us from regulating entities out there that are only profit-based and not about the broader South African public. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, colleagues. Very strong views, and I think there's a common theme coming across. And I hope that Mr. Taylor and Madame Jappi, you have taken note. The opportunity is now yours to respond to the questions and as much as you can. The floor is yours, colleagues from Bolt.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will take a few of the first questions and then Mr. Taylor will proceed with the remainder of the questions. Regarding Honorable Hunsinger's questions around the competition market inquiry, I'd like to draw the committee's attention to slide 19 of our presentation regarding the pricing controls and determination. The Competition Commission, correctly so, as Honorable Hunsinger mentioned, published the preliminary report on the public passenger transport market inquiry. One of those reports, it was a combination of a set of reports that were published under the market inquiry. One of those reports was specifically on metered taxis and e-hailing. In that Competition Commission preliminary report, which the Competition Commission must still finalize, they had stated that welfare enhancing benefits arising from digital platforms and the network externalities must be encouraged and preserved to the extent that they are and do not lead to competition distortions. The Competition Commission also further highlighted that fair regulation should not be introduced as it will seem to incur administrative burden for authorities and its inflexibility to address changing market dynamics, and therefore price regulation in general acts as a disincentive for innovation. Bolt, along with other participants in the public passenger transport sector, also participated in the process of the commission, as well as other subsectors like the meter taxi industry as well. Regarding Honorable Mabena's questions around regulation, we would like to emphatically state that Bolt supports regulation and welcomes regulation. That's why we remain in support of the National Land Transport Amendment Bill and its expedition assent into law, including implementation thereof immediately, as this provides for the necessary clarity in respect of the provisioning for the regulatory framework applicable to e-hailing. But in the absence of that, we remain compliant with the existing NLCA of 2009. And we are also regulated by the PREs and the MREs in respect of the issuance of operating licenses. And we remain a regulated sector at all levels of government. I'll now hand over to Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Wissal. So I think the next were the questions from Honorable Ramadwa, just on the regulation of pricing and how it's possible for us to find optimal pricing without it being regulated. In this regard, I just want to highlight the fact that competition is what drives these forces with regards to pricing. So just to remind all the honorable members that our platform is a two-sided marketplace. There are drivers and there are passengers. On the driver side, if the rates that we charge or that the drivers are able to earn from each trip are too low, there are other competitors in the market that they are then able to go to in order to offer their services onto those platforms. So we need to ensure that the rates that are applicable and that the drivers are able to earn with regards to the fares are competitive in that regard and that they're enabled to earn well, otherwise they will go elsewhere. On the passenger side, if the rates are too high, they will not use our service, therefore go to other competitors in the e-hailing space. Alternatively, they'll use another mode of public transport that suits them better. So what our contention is that market forces control that, and it is important to encourage a competitive economy so that we can ensure that the consumers are getting the best rates and the drivers are getting the best earnings possible. Then with regards to the issue of safety, there are a number of safety measures and protocols that are in place to ensure and improve the safety of users on our platform, and that is for both drivers and riders. And that starts from the screening process for drivers, where, as is the requirement for e-hailing services in the industry, we require a professional driver's permit in order for drivers to be able to operate on the platform. In order for this, they need to have a clear criminal background. We then do an additional criminal background check of our own that is privately done to ensure that all drivers that come onto the platform do not have a criminal record. In addition to that, we then have a partnership with Namola, who is a local crime response and crime fighting app, where if individuals have pushed a button, they are then able to get a call back within 90 seconds, and Namola is then able to dispatch the relevant emergency response that is required, whether that's armed response in the time of critical incident, or if it is the paramedics, and they also have very good relationships with staffs nationwide, so that they are able to contact them and refer that to them as well. In addition, we also have the ability where passengers, before they get into a vehicle, are able to see the vehicle type, the model, the driver, the driver's name. They're even able to see the driver's picture before they come. They are able to track the vehicle coming to them so they know exactly which vehicle it is that they need to be getting into. These are all measures that are in place to ensure that the passengers are getting into the correct vehicles. In addition to that, users of the platform are able to share their trip. They are able to share their location whilst they are on a trip with anyone who they choose. And these are incredible measures in place that aren't in other modes of public transport outside of e-hailing. So we really feel that Bolt, we've done a large number of things to try and ensure the safety of drivers and passengers on the platform. That said, we're constantly looking for new ways and better ways for us to be able to do that, giving drivers more information about trips so that they're in a better position to know whether to accept a trip or not, or whether it's unsafe. Then with regards to the question from Honorable Nolochungo about it being profitable and price controls, once more, I just want to reiterate that if the pricing on both the driver side and the rider side is not attractive, that because of competitive market dynamics, they will go elsewhere. So on the driver side, these are individuals often. There is a high number of individuals who, percentage of individuals who do not do lots of hours every week. This is a mode of earning for them where they are underemployed elsewhere and they now have the flexibility to be able to earn additional income whilst using the Bolt platform. So we are able to attract individuals who are earning in a part-time and then individuals who choose to drive for longer hours every week as well. So if the earnings per hour is not attractive for those individuals who are working, then they're going to find other ways of being able to work elsewhere and we're not able to attract them. So it's very important that the hourly earnings for individuals who are operating as drivers on our platform is competitive to other options that are out there in the market. And in the same way, in terms of modes of transport for users, that they have, or commuters or passengers, that they have the ability to have good priced fares in the market, otherwise they're going to use others. With regards to the same safety question, I think I answered that from the previous one. There was then a question with regards to our prices being almost 50% cheaper than Uber's. So I can't comment on Uber's pricing strategy. However, what I can say is that we recently launched a lower cost category. This is in the interests of, there are two interests, once again, on both sides of our platform. One is to increase the earnings of drivers on our platform. So where they are underutilized, they have the ability to opt in for specific sort of lower cost category. They also have the ability. Sorry, I'm Honorable Chairperson. Thank you. Sorry. They have the ability to be able to opt into this lower cost category. And in addition, what we're also doing here is trying to democratize access to transport here for individuals to be able to get a transport using a door-to-door service as well, where people who otherwise might not be able to have access to this, where they now do have access. So this is a lower cost category with different definitions of the vehicle types that are allowed to operate on that platform. In addition to that, we've made it available for drivers on normal vehicles to opt in and be able to offer trips with those lower fare so that they can increase their earnings. The other question was how much goes to the drivers? We take a 20% commission from drivers who operate on our platform. That means that the drivers keep 80% of the fare that comes to them. We then also do rider discounts, which encourage riders to take more trips because we make it a little bit cheaper for them. That is paid for by Bolt. So every rand that we pay for on the demand side for those rider campaigns then goes to the drivers as well. So let's say, for example, we spend 10% on those discounts. That's an additional 10% that would be going to the drivers, which means that effectively 90% of the earnings is going to drivers on a weekly or monthly basis. Then with regards to, there was a question from Honorable McDonald with regards to who owns these vehicles. I think there was an assumption made that these vehicles are owned by White Monopoly Capital. I would ask for the evidence base of this statement. From our experience, this ownership of these vehicles actually empowers thousands of South Africans to buy to let vehicles in the same way they would buy to let properties or homes. However, there is a vast section of our economy that is not able to buy homes for, you know, half a million rand to be able to let it out. But now what they are able to do is buy to let a car that perhaps costs 200,000 rand. And the incredible thing about this industry is that from month one, it is cash flow positive. That means that with these individuals who are buying and owning these vehicles, they are then able to make a profit on those vehicles from month one. And what we have seen is that this actually is empowering many South Africans and would contend with that comment. I think I have answered all of the questions that were posed to us, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. Colleagues, apologies. I have been dropped on another gadget, but so my face is hidden. I hope my voice is audible. Colleagues, those are the responses. We have made considerable catching up on time, and I would want to be generous and give colleagues maybe a last opportunity if you've got any follow-up. I know I didn't do it for Uber because the time was really, really tight, but I've got a little bit of time before we go to our last presenter for the day. So colleagues, if you are feeling that there's something burning, you want to say, let me see your hands. I hope I'll be able to see it here. And it will really be burning, colleagues. Let's not open up new questions. I really beg of you, as otherwise I will not do it again. So I only see two hands. Can I confirm these are the only two hands that have got brief follow-up? I see number three. I see two now. Colleagues, last chance. All right. These are the only three hands I will take as follow-up. I will start with Honorable Nolo Chungu.
Sorry, Chairperson. Sorry, Chairperson, I also would like to ask a question. Thank you, Pete May.
Okay. All right. Honorable May, you will come immediately after Honorable Nolu Chungu.
Yes.
And thereafter, it will be Honorable, excuse me, something happened. Let me start. It will be Honorable Nolu Chungu, Honorable Pete May, Honorable Ramadwa, and lastly, Honorable Hunsinger. Please, colleagues, as brief as you can. Thank you. Honorable Nolu Chungu.
Thank you, Chair. No, it was a mistake. My hands wasn't up.
All right. Thank you so much. Honorable May.
Thank you, Chairperson. All I want to say is I support Mr. Taylor. We, as the Freedom Front, we believe in free market system. I think we must stay away from government interference. I think it's Bolt as well as Uber, they are doing very, very good job. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable May. Honorable Hunsinger, I think. Yes. Or Ramadwa. No, it's Honorable Ramadwa. The floor is
yours. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Mine is not follow up, but to indicate that my question was not answered. The one that I have asked, where is this controlled? Bolt is being controlled. Thank you. It was not answered.
All right. Thank you, Honorable Ramadwa. Last but not least, Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for those answers. In your expression of market forces, I identify two sides of market force, price being in the middle. On the one hand, I have the relationship between price and consumer, and on the other side, you have price and driver. Which, in your thinking and belief of market forces, would be the leading and which would be the trailing variable, Mr. Taylor?
Thank you very much, Honorable Hunsinger and all the other colleagues. If you could drop your hands, I will truly appreciate it. Colleagues, you have an opportunity to clarify yourselves, Mr. Taylor and Ms. Yapi, and then we will wrap it up. Thank you. It is over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Firstly, I just want to apologize to Honorable Ramadwa for not answering her question. I please forgive me. I missed that in trying to go over all of my notes. So Bolt has a local entity that is registered in South Africa, Bolt Services ZA, which is in good standing. In addition to that, there is the technology company, which is where the technology houses is housed, because it's a software and technology company, and that is in Estonia. Then with regards to Honorable Hunsinger's question with regards to market forces, and this being on the rider side versus the driver side, and which one is leading and following versus failing, our contention is that this is a dual-sided marketplace, and it is incredibly important for us to match both sides. And in a similar way that dynamic pricing seeks to optimize earnings for drivers, optimize the number of trips on the platform, in the same way, the pricing that we seek to do seeks to optimize earnings on the driver side and to optimize the number of trips on the rider side. So that is what we try to then do, is ensure that there is a balance on this to optimize the hourly earnings for drivers on the platform. And the way to do that is by paying attention to both sides of the marketplace. So I contend that it isn't the fact that one is leading or the other isn't. If we don't have any drivers who choose to operate on the platform, there is no service on Bolt. If we don't have any riders who choose to use it at the fare, we don't have any passengers who are prepared to use this, and the driver, neither the drivers nor us make any money. So I contend that there isn't a more important market force for us to be paying attention to.
Thank you, Gareth. I would just like to state that if the committee wishes, Bolt may be able to provide our written comments in writing to the committee on the questions that the members have posed to us for the committee's purpose and information during deliberations going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much from the colleagues at BOLT. Once more, we want to appreciate your time, your efforts, your preparation. All right. Can we ask Honorable Nolu Chungu and Honorable May to please mute their mics? Thank you very much, colleagues. I was saying we do appreciate and note that it takes a lot of time to research and to prepare all the responses that you have prepared. And I do want to emphasize again that we appreciate your efforts. It assists us to be able to enrich and build this bill. As many colleagues have already said, that we are still at the early stages of this process, and therefore we appreciate all efforts that you put in. Should there be any request or requirement to anyone who presents for further clarity, the same process of how we submitted and how we have been communicating with you will certainly be followed. So rest assured, should we require anything in the same process that we got in touch with you to invite you, we will do exactly the same. So with those few words, I want to welcome again the presentation and your time. And you are most welcome to stay on. However, should you wish to take leave, you are also most welcome. Thank you once more. Colleagues, we are going to the last presenter, and who is Dr. Blackmore. He is a private individual who is commenting on the bill, exercising his rights. And I have been informed that he doesn't have a PowerPoint presentation. Therefore, he will be speaking from his notes. So I would appeal with colleagues that we be attentive and take the notes as much as we can as he is speaking. But you might not be able to refer to a particular slide. So on that note, colleagues, we are doing well. And I'd like to say good morning, Dr. Blackmore. Welcome to the Portfolio Committee on Transport. I'm sure you have been following the deliberations, and at least you have understood the format of what we are taking as a committee. And I would like to hand over to you at this point in time. Thank you so much.
Chairperson, Ms. Masati, just assisting the doctor to get connected. There is a struggling with the link. So give us a minute or two, please.
You are most welcome. Colleagues, you can take a body break of 5 minutes. It's 11:40. At 11:45, we will continue. We hope by that time you will be fine. So make yourself a cup of coffee, stretch your body, and then 5 minutes, please, colleagues.
Doug, can you hear me? Dr. Blackmore, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well, Dr. Blackmore.
Okay.
Can you also switch on your camera?
It is on, I think.
Okay. No, it's fine, but I can definitely hear you. I can't see, but it's. Can you press on the stop video at the bottom of your screen, please?
Where it says start video, it's got a red line through it. Do you want me to press on that?
Yes, please, so that the line doesn't show anymore. I just want to see your face. Welcome. How are you today?
Yes, I'm very.
I can see you today. Welcome.
Yes, okay. Well, it's like...
The members took a five-minute breather. The meeting started at 9, so they've completed the Uber and the Bolt meeting. So they're just taking a break.
Yep.
And they will be back for you in the next 2 minutes. So you can stay online, keep your camera on, keep your mic on. We'll be
okay. And as you said to me yesterday, you want me to put on the mute button when I'm not talking? Is that right?
Yes, but for now, keep it on.
Yeah, I'll just leave it on.
Because I can hear your background is very quiet. So keep it on for now because we are going to go straight into your presentation now.
Okay.
Members are aware that you don't have a PowerPoint presentation and that you will be speaking to the notes.
Yes.
And the submission that has been given to members already a few weeks ago.
That's
welcome,
fantastic.
Doctor.
Thank you. Okay. And are you in the meeting yourself?
I am in the meeting, and there are quite a few people ready to listen to you today.
Okay. All right. I look forward to talking to them, and this is a new experience for me.
Yes, and we understand that when we go online, it is new, but there are other virtual hearings on at Parliament, so it is a new setup, and I'm grateful that you are open to this new experience, Doctor.
Oh, that's fine. When do you think you'll be resuming person-to-person meetings?
I'm not sure at this stage, I won't be able to actually comment on that because I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. But I do miss the person-to-person interaction. I see the acting chairperson, Mr. Mangu, is online now, and he'll be taking over from here. Thank you, Dr. Blackmore.
Thank you.
Dr. Blackmore, good morning.
Good morning, Honorable Deputy Chair.
How are you?
I'm extremely good, thank you, although I'm a little nervous about this new technology, but I guess we're all coming to grips.
I can tell you, all of us, with no fail, felt that at some point in time.
Okay, I think I'm in good company.
And I want to assure you that the technology will not bite you. None of the members of this committee will bite you.
Okay,
So please relax. Please be yourself. The process is really to give you an opportunity to present your views on the legislation bill in front of us.
Yes.
So just imagine you're in front of us personally and there was no issue.
Okay.
So I want you to please relax.
Yes.
And it's a very easy process.
All right.
We had taken a break, and I'm sure the honorable members are all back now. We had agreed to start at 11:45. So I would like at this point in time to resume the meeting, colleagues, and in welcoming once more Dr. Blackmore to the Portfolio Committee on Transport. We are aware that you will be presenting to us through your notes. What will happen is that at the end of your presentation, the members of the committee will pose some questions to you, or clarity-seeking questions or some comments. I would like, when we get to that point, to allow everybody to speak while you are taking your own notes. At the end of it, you will have an opportunity to also respond to those to the best of your ability. And at any point in time, if there's anything not clear, please do ask. There will be no issue. So welcome. We'd like you to go ahead, introduce yourself, and go straight into your presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and good morning again to you and also to the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. And it's a great privilege to be able to join you and to address this extremely important piece of legislation. I think in the document which I have distributed to you, I've given you some personal background, and I don't think it needs repetition. What I will do is invite any questions about my personal background from honourable members when it comes to question time, so I will leave it at that particular point. Let me go to my specific comments, please. And the first one there is I've raised a particular comment about the bill's definition of economic regulation. And I said that it's quite a limited definition. And I thought that it would be advisable if the committee might perhaps think a little bit more as to whether it has the best definition of economic regulation. And perhaps it might ask departmental officials to do a little more research on that particular matter and to satisfy itself that the best definition can be found within the bill when it eventually becomes an act. Now, if it's the pleasure of the committee, I can come back to you on this with perhaps some brief suggestions, but I didn't want to be prescriptive and actually write down a form of words, but I can certainly do that at a later stage if that would suit the purposes of the committee. One of the matters, and this is point two in my presentation, that I did want the committee to think about is, should the regulator have the power to address environmental issues associated with transport? When you look at it, my examples are fairly clear. Ships can pollute coastal waters. There's air and noise pollution associated with the activity of transport machinery. And I was just wondering if the committee thought that the scope of the bill might be extended to talk about environmental issues associated with transport. Now, I know that Section 43.11 deals with liaison with other regulatory bodies. And the committee may consider that this is sufficient, that the new regulatory, the transport regulator, may simply handle questions of environmental matters by liaising, maybe through a memorandum of understanding, with relevant environmental protection agencies. And if the committee thinks that that is the best approach, then I think that that would be a worthwhile way to do it. But if it would suit the committee, I can, and you can tell me at the end of these proceedings, I can come back with some more suggestions on the first and second points I've made about the regulator's powers. What I have noticed, though, is that if you look at the definition of economic regulation in the bill, it basically covers three matters: price, access, and service levels, or the quality of service in the transport industry. I just want to make one point about the quality of service levels. The regulator will need to set performance or quality standards. And this can be quite a complex task. And I just wanted to draw to the committee's attention that this matter of standards is absolutely critical. Unless you have the well-defined performance standards, then the regulator will find it very difficult to hold the transport industry to account over the matter of quality or the matter of service levels. So, Chair, I just foreshadow that as an issue which may be extremely important in the future. The third point that I've raised for the Honourable Committee's attention is the Bill's definition of a market. The wording of the Bill talks about a place, and I suppose some people might think that it's talking about a specific physical place. Most people probably won't, but as I say in my notes, modern markets are often electronic markets. They're not a place at all. They're a place in the electronic space, and perhaps the concept of a market might be broadened a little to take that into account. The fourth point is the idea where I say a definition of oversight should be added in that list of definitions at the beginning of the bill. I know it's probably a difficult concept to put into sort of legal framework, but I think some effort or some thought needs to be given to it, because as you go through the bill, you will see that oversight is one of the board's key responsibilities. And I'm just wondering with the committee if it might be wise to define that power quite specifically, more so than it's in the definitions at the moment. Some legal advice might be helpful here. And it's a question on which I could come back to the committee with more thoughts, if that suited your convenience and your approach. But I would not like to see this new regulator burdened with sort of legal fights over the extent of nature of its oversight, and maybe we could preempt any of those problems if we attended to the issue of definition in more detail in the bill when it becomes an act. The fifth point I've asked the Honourable Committee to think about is that Section 8.1 of the bill provides for negotiated agreements between parties in the industry, people who are seeking access to infrastructure and the owners of infrastructure. I get the impression from Section 8.1 of the bill that this might be self-regulation, and it might be something that the committee may prefer to maximise as far as possible. And I don't disagree with that, but it's been my experience in other quarters that even if there is a voluntary agreement between access seekers and infrastructure owners, the regulator should subject those agreements to what I've called in my notes a public interest test. We never know. Agreements between parties might be against the public interest sometimes. And I think the regulator would need to be alive to that and to say, well, even if you've come to an agreement amongst yourselves, and we're going to apply a public interest test just to make sure that it's in the interest of consumers, that it's in the interest of public policy, and so on. So I'm suggesting that you give serious thought to the idea that we don't allow access seekers and infrastructure owners